Scientists on this program describe extreme risks as the world heats up. But is it enough to study and publish in journals seldom read by the public? A growing number of scientists say no to a future which could include extinction. They formed the movement Scientist Rebellion and mounted civil disobedience actions in several countries, coinciding with the release of the latest big climate report in early April. Let's find out more with one of those scientists, William Livernois. Will is a graduate student researcher at University of Washington in Seattle. Will Livernois, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I just want to be a quick thing about that. I and I bring the institution I work for into this at all. Just putting that out there.
Right. And every scientist I talk to says that. I'm speaking for myself personally, not for the institution. So I think my listeners get it okay. Now, what is Scientist Rebellion and where did it start? Do you know?
Well, Scientist Rebellion started kind of as a sister movement to Extinction Rebellion. The Extinction Rebellion movement, which started in the United Kingdom, the Extinction Rebellion was started in 2018. The first rebellion was the Fall Rebellion in 2018. And so the Extinction Rebellion has grown and evolved over time. And kind of the Scientist Rebellion started as a couple of organizers of the Extinction Rebellion thought and felt that there was a need to focus on getting scientists involved because of kind of the whole problem is about science. It's literally that's the climate ecological crisis. Like, it's talking about climate scientists doing all this research, and there is kind of a disconnect between the scientific community and or at least the media portrays that there to be a disconnect between the scientific community and like the activists that you see on the street. So there's this idea that we need everyone to get involved, and that's the kind of motivation.
Well, up to now, I think the way it's been seen, the game is played. Scientists are just independent fact finders who avoid anything controversial or political. What changed?
I think that is true. The scientists are the goal of science is to be unbiased and kind of create discoveries that really question all of your underlying assumptions and present your findings in as clear a way as possible. However. I mean, there is something to be said that we have informed science as humans, and so that we can't really divorce that part, our humanity from our work, really, right? So when the science is clearly telling us that, we're on a path towards extinction or not even, when the stakes are so high, I feel like that goes out the window a little bit, because how can you present the findings that all these gloom and doom findings, and yet continue forward like with business as usual, without questioning how we got here and like what we can do to change.
Well, it's interesting. I think science itself was founded in the 1600s, probably by Bacon, by trying to avoid the ability of the human mind to delude itself. During the Middle Ages, he felt humans had deluded themselves about many things. And so how can you check against the outside universe to see that what you're thinking is real? And I think scientists have done that, and there isn't enough of that in this society. Right now, there's a lot of question about what's real, what facts are, and scientists can actually answer a lot of that.
Yeah, that is something that is pretty unfortunate with the times, is that you see science itself is politicized, especially in the United States. And so I think that's also part of it, is that now there's understanding that we're in this, like this is political whether or not we want it to be. And so why wouldn't we, fight back,
Yes. Well, now we have scientists protesting outside a German ministry and at the British headquarters for energy giant Shell. There were more scientists protests in April in Mexico, Italy, Spain. Some of the American scientist protests are from major government-funded institutions like Oak Ridge National Laboratory and NASA. Now, once again, those people did it as their own personal belief and not representing that. But, just a few years ago in the Bush administration, that kind of thing might have been forbidden.
I don't think that this has ever been allowed, and I don't think it is being allowed right now. Like that is what Scientist Rebellion is saying, is that it's work in the framework of nonviolent direct action, which means breaking the rules. But the thing is that there is a kind of a desperation and you know, a strategy to that, which is that we have these contracts with, you know, there is an inherent contract with the government and, you know, the institutions that they will be protecting us, and they are not doing that. And so that's kind of the underlying strategy, is that in order for that, the things that have to change very, very quickly. And the data points to that. Like what the unbiased data says that things have to, like the newest IPCC report says that we have to peak, you know, greenhouse gas emissions before 2025. And even that's considered conservative by, you know, other scientists. So we've come to a point where whether or not something is forbidden, like shouldn't deter like the underlying obligation that we have to really shake things up.
Well, some of the early science voices breaking through were kind of punished with death threats and attempts to get them fired. Dr. Michael Mann of Penn State was just trying to publicize evidence that the world is warming fast, much faster than in the past. And he was crucified by right-wing media and not very well supported by other scientific institutions at the time. It's getting better. He's written a couple books about it. He's decided, okay, this is my role. I'll take it on. Is it easier now?
I think that there's a growing consensus that that, you know, climate scientists have been right. I mean, this is not a new issue anymore. This has been, people have been doing this research for decades, and scientists have continued to deep dive into the problem and, you know, question underlying assumptions and create better models. And so, I don't think that specifically has changed the public, like, discourse directly, but there's kind of an understanding that we see the climate crisis playing out all here and throughout the world. Like, we are in it. So I think there's a fundamental change in our understanding that's starting to happen. And, you know, we're hoping, you know, that it continues and that things do change for the better.
Well, let's talk about your own path to climate activism. Will, you are definitely a scientist. I looked up some of your early papers and presentations. You led one checking out whether electric properties of bacteria could be used to create nanowires. I had to do a lot of research to find out what you were even talking about. Is that what it was about? And if it's true, how could that knowledge be used?
Yeah, well, I love the work that I do. I do modeling, currently work on modeling at the atomic level, looking at applying physics models to, you know, to biomolecules to look at their electronic properties. Something that's made me really passionate about this project is that it's cool to be able to use natural things to create, create electronics, and that gives me some hope for how we can do things more sustainably in the future. One thing that is hard is that working on a lot of this stuff feels there's definitely a disconnect between where the kind of applications of the stuff that I'm doing research on and the implementation and kind of how to scale that up versus like where we're headed for as the planet Earth right now. And that's kind of what causes me to spend so much time doing organizing work, because I value the work that I do, and I clearly have a strong passion about the science and the physics, but I want that to be actually be useful for people. And in order for that to be useful, there needs to be a future to live in that, can have these cool technologies. So, that's constantly an internal battle for me, I think.
That makes just such total sense. And, you know, I've talked to some really technophiles, people who just love technology, but they don't seem to take into account what you just said, that we've got to be here with an organized society and a civilization capable of using this technology, and we won't be if we don't transition out of where we are right now.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. One of your early actions was against Line 3 tar sands pipeline extension through the land of the Anishinaabe, I hope I've said that correctly, Aboriginal land of Minnesota. The Canadian energy company Enbridge was working hard to get the dirtiest oil in the world through to eastern refineries. Line 3 was completed, though, and oil is flowing through it right now. Why did you get involved in that, and were protesters arrested there?
Yeah, so I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's been a really big fight recently. And the news coming out of it is not super, super great. I mean, as you said, the Line 3 has been built and there is oil flowing through it. But, I mean, there is still a large, there are a lot of cases in courts and growing, concern about, you know, environmental effects that are being raised. But, you know, I went as a concerned citizen and, you know, participated in the way, best way that I could. So Line 3 has a lot of issues. I mean, I think it's a really important thing to talk about, because it combines not only the climate, you know, the climate science, the fact that we need to halt fossil fuel production as soon as possible, but it also has the climate justice piece of it, and also the fact that in the U.S. and also in other parts of the world, the indigenous leaders are kind of leading that fight, and they're not getting, you know, a lot of the attention that they should be getting, because they have been leading this fight for a while. So I really wanted to go and support that. I was not the organizer. I wanted to go and use my body where I was needed. And yeah, there were a lot of arrests from that action, a series of actions. I think there were over 1,000.
They're still fighting Line 3, as you say, through the courts and other methods. And now there's a campaign to try and shut down Pipeline 5 that Enbridge wants to push through Michigan. So it's a continuing battle to stop the construction of oil infrastructure, as even the UN Secretary General says that oil, fossil fuels, they're weapons of mass destruction. All right, now tell me if I get this correctly about you. While you're working on your PhD for a doctorate, you also become a permaculture consultant for a company called C Combinator, which recently renamed itself to Carbon Wave. Did I get that right? And if so, tell us about the project.
Yeah, so I've been working with them on the scaling of a carbon sequestration project. So that project uses the seaweed, sargassum seaweed, to which is a very fast-growing seaweed and actually kind of a problem in the Gulf of Mexico as a way of sequestering carbon. And currently, I think they're focusing on a lot of the applications to create products that could be used, you know, in different sectors. But what I was working on was the scaling up of that project and doing modeling to see the feasibility and also the costs and actual carbon sequestration, like costs for scaling that up. And so the idea would be to create these large arrays that would be growing seaweed in the ocean, and, you know, very exciting work. I wish that, you know, there were more of those kind of projects. I happen to be very lucky to get involved with that, because I know somebody who I had the connections to be able to get involved. And it's kind of insane that projects like that are not happening more. Like there was definitely a timeline to really scale that up as soon as possible. But I think that's subject to the current system that we have, where these kind of they have to produce a profitable thing within, you know, our, you know, capitalism, or, you know, whatever, the system that we have in order to be able to move forward. But yet the scaling up of that project would be so, you know, with the carbon sequestration project, it would be so useful to carbon drawdown. And I see this as a bigger issue with a lot of the scientific research that's been done, which gets, you have to apply for funding sources with, and there's all that process. There's a huge timeline for the turnaround time for like some of these research projects. And yet, the need for it is so, we need it immediately, and we need it to be growing immediately. And we need all hands on deck to kind of work on these projects.
Yes. You imagine a doctor in an emergency room with a patient that's in critical condition, but he has to fill out some forms and wait for a while for the bandages to come from another floor. That's not going to work out, and I see that is part of the problem of the funding of climate science as well. Although I think in China, they're starting to really speed up their funding of climate science, and we can see the result in so many papers coming out with Chinese lead authors and co-authors. Will, can you tell us, how is Scientist Rebellion organized, and what are the goals?
So Scientist Rebellion, we have a set of principles and kind of a general goal. Our tagline is, we 1.5C is dead, climate revolution now, and that kind of implies that the current science as we know it shows that to get below 1.5 degrees C of warming is showing to be really unlikely, even in the best case scenarios. And so we feel like we need to fight for every fraction of a degree there is, no matter what that leads us to. So there's that piece of it, kind of what the underlying principles are, but then we have a very like horizontal structure where we really try to make everybody's voices heard who gets involved in our organizing. So currently there's, you know, we said this April Rebellion had 27 plus countries, I think maybe it's 28 countries at this point who are involved. And, you know, as we're speaking, there's a lot of data being transferred, like people talking about the different actions, and there's still more photos coming out of everything that's gone on. But it's been really cool to see that the horizontal structure means that every country or every region has their own like working groups that are putting together actions and media and really trying to do outreach. I mean, I specifically haven't been involved in the central strategy discussion, but what's come out of that is basically a series of a kind of agreements that we all have. We've included different working groups to try to improve the equity. There's this whole, you know, we have in the climate movement, it's like a very, for either people, there's a lot of criticism about how white it is, how much privilege that we have. One thing that's pretty cool about Scientist Rebellion is that I think we have a very good representation of many different parts of the world, including a large, pretty large representation of the Global South. And we're really trying to work towards improving the relationships and making sure that that one of the pillars that we talk about is, you know, a just transition that empowers, makes things equitable for everyone. And so we're, I think there's a lot of discussions now that we have kind of more numbers and a lot of a momentum on how we can improve our structure to be more equitable to that.
Scientists put out more dire warnings, but the fossil fuel party is still getting stronger. Emissions are going up. A very few climate scientists say that we already know enough about all this. We should maybe stop research and work for action instead. Could there be a scientist strike, and would that be a good idea?
Yeah, well, one of the things about this April mobilization that we had in this past week was that there were strikes at multiple universities, lots of universities around the world. That is, I think that's definitely in the cards and definitely part of what we do, or what we've kind of planned as Scientist Rebellion. And I would have to agree with that point. I kind of think that you hear climate scientists talking about all the different ways they've proved that global warming, you know, that climate change is caused by CO2 emissions, like looking at isotopes in the atmosphere and stuff like this, and then looking at the different warming models and looking at, there's a development of the climate models that'll look at like square kilometer resolution of like how warming will affect us. And it's like, I agree. Like, it's like, well, how specific do we want to get? Like, it's very clear, like what's going on. And so I would agree with the strategy of science strike. And I think one of the criticisms that I've already heard about that is that, well, are you really, like, your scientists are supposed to be, like, working on solutions for us. And the thing that keeps coming up is that there are so many solutions that need to be, that have a lot of work to be done. Like, clearly there's a lot of connections that need to be made between the climate scientists, the policymakers, and the engineers who are actually implementing these solutions. And there's, you know, a lot of communication that needs to happen. But what's also clear is that there needs to be, like, a turning of people to understand that we are in an emergency mode, and that there needs to be as you said, things need to change very quickly. You look at the actual emissions curve, and it's just a horizontal, it's not a horizontal line, it's a line with a positive slope. Like, it has not changed despite all of these different, the IPCC reports and the different actions, intergovernmental actions that have happened, like the Paris Agreement. And you think about that from the perspective of, like, I don't know, just like a simple calculus. You're like, okay, that curve needs to bend downwards, or it needs to plateau and bend downwards. And the you take the derivative of that curve, and it's like, oh man, like that seems really hard to do. But we do have all of these. People have researched these solutions a lot, and so that's why it feels like there needs to be a more focus on mobilizing people and getting everybody to become a climate activist, as Peter Kalmus talks about.
I think all of our listeners have to become climate activists if they're not already. Many are, but it just comes down to that. We're going to have to all move. And there seem to be two age groups where scientists are speaking up most. At first, it was older scientists at or nearing retirement, and they could sort of risk institutional censorship. But lately, it's been undergrads and young scientists are stepping up. One example is Kyle Toffer. He's a master's student at Technische Universität in Dresden, And just prior to COP26 in November 2021, Kyle quit to mobilize with Zionist Rebellion Germany. Why do you think the young are speaking out now on this climate danger?
We understand that that is our future. Like I think of myself as pretty young. I'm 26. I don't have the credentials. I don't have a master's yet or a PhD. I have scientific research experience, but I'm risking that or whatever in doing the things that I do. But the understanding is this is our future, and we've grown up with this messaging. Like I remember sitting down with my family and watching Inconvenient Truth how old was I? I must have been 13. And really, you know, it really freaked me out. And I got the messaging that we're going to be able to fix this. Like this is all, there's all these technological solutions that are going to come. But here we are, 2022, and things are not improving. And so I think we understand what's at stake a little bit.
Yeah, I wonder how long it will be before employers in the public and private sector reward scientists who are truthful about climate danger. I'd love to hear the job interview where the applicant is asked to explain why they did not speak up when they knew the crisis is real. May we come to that day? What are your thoughts?
I mean, I know that when you're there, there's a lot of talk about, especially applying to graduate school or even applying to research positions. There is some talk of how have you contributed to your community and how have you contributed equitability in the field and stuff like that. And I think this is a way of doing that. And so perhaps that could be rewarded. But I like what you're saying that there should be ways in our system to reward that. I do think that. One of the things that we talk about in the Scientist Rebellion, especially talking to new folks, is that we really want to make this a standard thing for scientific institutions. Like nonviolent direct action needs to become normal because we need people to listen to it, to the science and listen to what we're saying, by we meaning climate scientists. And so, yeah, that's something that is definitely a goal for us.
I think one of the problems is that so many students, especially in America, have to borrow large amounts of money to get through and get their degree, especially if it's a PhD. And then they're worried that if they have a record of protest or arrest, that will keep them from getting good positions after they graduate, but they're going to need to get good pay to pay that money back. So it's almost like a silencing is built into the system, I think.
Yeah, I actually have something to say about that, though, and that's that I do feel like I'm in a position where I can do these kind of things because I have come from a pretty privileged background, and I am not, I don't have a lot of debt, and I also am in the position that I am in because I have this fellowship and stuff like that, and that's not for everyone, and I understand that not everyone can take the risks that I maybe take. The thing is that there are a lot of roles for all of those people. Like there are numerous support roles. There's also just education roles, just talking to people around you. So I don't want to say that people who are taking more risks are doing it because they're better than somebody else. There is clearly everybody has their own background that they're coming from.
Yes, we used to have that in the climate movement when you were going out. Some people would say, well, I just can't get arrested, and here's my reasons why, And so it was really a choice about whether you were going to be arrested or not. But I have to tell people, you can go on all sorts of protests without any chance of arrests. You can get out into the streets and make your voice heard. You can do the old letter writing thing, except who does that? Social media, whatever you can do. And I think Scientists' Rebellion is a really welcome thing. And I'm hoping that I'll have more guests, scientists on this show say, oh, yeah, I'm part of that. Where do you see your own climate activism going, Will, as we wrap up here?
Well, I coming out of our most recent action, it was it was very successful. I'm surprised. I kind of have been on the periphery of Scientist Rebellion for a while. I've joined all the chats since 2020, but I was pleasantly surprised at how things came together, and that's giving us a lot of hope for what we can do next. Yeah, and I imagine that there will be more things coming up, and that'll be very exciting. And I don't know what the future holds, of course. I kind of just want to do the next thing that is the right thing. So I will continue doing that whenever way I can.
As should we all. From the University of Washington, but speaking for himself, is graduate student researcher William Livernois. And Will is speaking up on climate change as part of Scientist Rebellion, and that's what we've been talking about. You can find out more at scientistrebellion.com with follow-up links in my show blog at ecoshock.org as well. Will, thank you for what you're doing and for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.